This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Some people very kindly took out a quotation. It is from page, what page? Page 10, Hagar the Horrible. Two of them sitting over a mug of beer, says the one to the other, "You know what I miss?" "What?" says the guy with the horns. "The joys of married life." "Aren't you married?" says the guy with the horns. "Yeah, but so far I've missed the joys." So at least those of you who are missing the joys, you know you're not the only ones. And that's what we're here to try and discuss and understand and prevent. Now, in last week's talk, we established the degree to which the initial prime responsibility, I don't want to say the prime responsibility, but the initial prime responsibility. Marriage is a system of dynamics, and it has to start somewhere. Once it starts, and if it starts on the right basis, if it starts on the right foot, one thing triggers off the other. The initial prime responsibility is with the husband. He's the cornerstone, that the pillar rests, that the pillar of marriage rests on the foundation, which is the husband. He must have his house in order. A husband who's not able to handle his role in marriage is going to cause problems within the marriage. It's going to be a problematic marriage. It doesn't mean it's going to land up in divorce. It doesn't mean it's going to be permanently unhappy. But it needs readjustment and reorganization. It either needs educating the husband, or it needs a reversal of roles. The wife has to be taught how to take over certain of the husband's roles. But it's a problematic marriage. A husband who doesn't take his side of the responsibility, as we discussed, in terms of what we discussed last week, such a marriage is a problematic marriage and will be a problematic marriage. And most problematic marriages are problematic because of that. That's where it starts. We talked about man's responsibilities being the responsibility of ownership, being the responsibility of being fully responsible for something which is yours, and not viewing marriage as a partnership, but rather as a shareholding, as an investment relationship. One is invested in one's wife. One possesses her. One owns her. And a wife, as we're going to see later on, doesn't feel degraded by being possessed. She feels proud and she feels loved. And that's what she wants, to be possessed by a man she admires more than anybody else. But if there's another man she admires more than her husband, she doesn't feel like being possessed by him. That we will discuss. We talked about the responsibility of ownership expressing itself in three prime areas. The sensitivity and understanding necessary for a man to adjust to what a woman is. And not to expect a woman to become a man, and not to expect her to change miraculously. He's meant to know enough about her before he marries her to know what he's taking on. We'll see still that to know her before he's married is not possible. But he's expected to know enough about what a woman is, at least, to understand what it means taking responsibility for a wife. And I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that most of the complaints that husbands have about their wives are not complaints of theirs about their wives at all, but they're complaints about women. They're not specific to their wives. When a husband says, "I can't stand it anymore," "What can't you stand? She's driving me crazy. What is it?" And he'll quote an incident which is just a normal human reaction, normal human behavior for a woman. Just something he hasn't adjusted to, just something he hasn't understood, but that's how women function. And one can mold that behavior and one can direct that behavior, but one can't change that behavior. And most of the times that a husband is complaining about irritating aspects of his wife's behavior, it's not restricted to his wife, it's feminine behavior to which he has been unable to adjust. And the inability to adjust started a long time back, when he didn't fully understand, when he stood under that chuppah, what it was he was taking on. And he didn't enter that marriage with a full enough commitment to responsibility. There wasn't the understanding, there wasn't the sensitivity, which is the first requisite for the responsibility we've been discussing. The second was the imposition. The ability to impose value systems and behavior systems onto one's wife. Not to try and establish peaceful coexistence. There is nothing more destructive to a marriage than peaceful coexistence. Two people, a husband and a wife, living together, or rather living next to one another, not living together, living next to one another without arguing with one another. That's a marriage that just doesn't face issues. That's a marriage that isn't functioning. One requires a husband who has a sufficiently clear world view for himself, with sufficient confidence in his world view, able to impose that, not negotiate it, impose it on his wife. And again, she must respect him sufficiently and admire him sufficiently and have sufficient confidence in him to be able to accept his worldview. Or to argue with it. There's nothing that says that a woman is not entitled to argue with her husband and to try and change his mind and to try and persuade him. But if she fails, she has to accept his view. And the third area was in always giving, with a big problem in modern Western men, whose need to love, to be loved, is greater than his need to love. And the discussion that we had, that is one of the most dangerous aspects of a marriage, that a man goes into the marriage needing to be loved. That's not what marriage is for, as far as the man is concerned. It's needing to love. And it's in the marriage that he expresses that love. And that's all that he really needs out of the marriage, is a need to give forth of his love, for which he needs to have some love to give, which, let me tell you, not all men have. And having the love, he needs to know how and be willing to give that love. This leads us into another area, which we touched on last week, which is that, obviously, in every marriage, a man is constantly receiving from his wife too. She's doing things for him, as we discussed last week, from morning till night, sacrificing her life for him. The only way he can still remain in a giving situation, despite all that he is receiving, is through the mechanism of Hakarat HaTov, which is permanent emotional indebtedness. He has to feel and respond in a way where he always demonstrates his indebtedness to her for what she is. When a husband starts failing to show recognition, quite apart from the idea that we expressed last week of having to honor a wife in order to make her feel a queen rather than a maidservant, quite apart from that, just for a man to retain his own independence, for a man to retain his own giving ability. Anthony Druin, where were you last week? And you weren't even at Counterpoint. I went to look for you there. You just skipped it and you didn't even try to get a tape. Quite apart from needing to honor the wife for her own good, it's necessary for a husband to feel his independence, despite everything he's getting, by how much he's giving back, and by him showing her how almost uncomfortable he feels at the inordinate amount that he is receiving from his wife, which he can't really give back, which it is impossible to give back. There must be that feeling of pressure inside him, which expresses itself in his behavior towards her, that she feels all the time, at least, that through all this giving, it's making him give more, and it's making him give more. And another problem, and it's part of the same problem that we face in modern marriage, the first problem I mentioned is the need to be loved rather than the need to love. The second problem, which we face primarily in South Africa, but very closely tied to this first problem, is the problem of the spoiled adult, or the spoiled child who becomes an adult, and a spoiled adult at that. Being spoiled is simply, as a child, having things done for you which you're perfectly capable of doing yourself. And a spoiled child who goes into marriage without having become unspoiled before then goes expecting it. And when his wife puts the food on the table, he's used to it. That's what his mother used to do, and that's what his servant does, and that's what everybody does for him. And whatever she does for him, he takes for granted. He takes as his right and as his due. Even if it is his right and even if it is his due, by not showing and feeling the indebtedness, he loses his independence completely. He no longer is a giver, he's a taker. He's a schlepper, he's a drain on her. Plain and simple, a drain. She has to feel that for what she's done for him, he is demonstrating his inability to pay her back. And going all out in other ways, in every way he can, to give her back for what she's done for him. And that's how a relationship begins to develop. When a man feels embarrassed by taking, as every man should, he should always feel embarrassed to take from anybody, because it's a statement about his virility. For a man to take, that means you're not independent. So you should always feel embarrassed. That doesn't mean he shouldn't take. We live in a society, we give and we take all the time. A man has to take. But he has to feel a need to give back more than he's taken at all times. He has to feel a need to repay his debts. And when those debts are not able to be repaid, as usually is the case in interpersonal relationships, he has to be able to demonstrate his understanding that he is indebted beyond ability to repay. But that has to come out in his relationship to his wife. Yes, because we haven't started yet, so you can ask the question.
On this subject, if the woman is working, then does that threaten the relationship?
It can do. It can do, particularly where she starts earning more than he does.
If she doesn't, but she's just working, then should that not be done in the work?
We have a major problem here. The one problem is financial need sometimes. The other problem is that a woman today has a lot more time on her hands and a lot more intellectual and educational ability than she had a while back. And therefore she needs to express that educational ability and use that time creatively. And therefore, yes, a woman should have outside occupations, or an intelligent woman should have, let me say, there is nothing wrong with a woman having outside occupations, and even a job if that's what satisfies her. But it mustn't be out of need. It must be as a hobby. It mustn't be that she's supporting the family. And the husband must never feel that he's being supported by her, unless it's a temporary period. He's studying for a while and they agree together. It's in the family's interest. He'll be giving more to the family by studying for a couple of years and letting her support than he would be giving to the family by going out to work. Okay, that's the... So yes, a wife should have an outside interest even if it means work, but it shouldn't be that she's sent out to work to become the family support, and she shouldn't see herself in that role. And the husband mustn't stop giving her pocket money because she happens to be earning herself. And that's what she earns is for herself, and she can spend it on the family, and she can buy presents for her family, and all sorts of things, but that shouldn't become housekeeping money unless the family needs it. Right. Now, what about the wife? The wife, believe it or not, is much less complicated than the husband. The men are all laughing. All a wife needs is one thing. And it's not love. It's not money either. Does he give you enough money? The one thing that a wife needs is to be able to admire her husband at all times. With that, the marriage is safe. Without that, the marriage is doomed. Again, not doomed to failure in the sense of landing up in divorce, but doomed to complete stagnancy, difficulty, problem, emotional drain on both of them, and a slow decline. Sometimes not such a slow decline. That's all she needs. Now you'll notice that we haven't really had love. It wasn't necessary for a husband to love his wife to fulfill her. And we discussed where love comes in, that it's important to show her love and respect and all these things, but it was sensitivity, imposition, and the giving situation, which obviously includes love, but it's not this romantic love idea. We're going to still come to romantic love. But as a basis for marriage, romantic love is not necessary. And on the wife's side, all she needs is to be able to admire her husband. Without that admiration, when he imposes his will on her, that's chutzpah, that's all. It's plain and simple chutzpah. Who is he to tell me what to do? And that is the women's lib movement. When women lost their admiration for men, they turned around and said, who exactly does he think he is? Why does he have all the fun and not me? What's he telling me to do? Why should I work and slave for him? Let's share roles, let's swap roles, and the whole business started. And all the women wanted at that time, when women's lib really started and really became fashionable, and those of you who haven't been to the States have no idea how powerful the women's lib movement really is. It's an extremely powerful movement. All the women wanted when they started that was, excuse the saying, but they wanted their husbands to turn them over on their knees and give them a little spanking and send them right back to the kitchen. not meaning that that's their place. But they just wanted a statement from a husband saying, I'm capable of it, this is what I'm doing, and if we want this marriage to work, this is how it's working. If you want to have fun and go and have a profession as well, that's fine, but that comes second to the home. Your first responsibility is to the home. Leave the making of the money to me. If you want to have some fun and you've got the time for it, take a university degree, enter into a career, do what you want. But understand what your function is in the home. That's how it is. And women would have felt secure. You know, it's like a little child that comes. Imagine your child comes to you. You say, go to bed. And the child says, who are you to tell me to go to bed? You say, sorry, you can stay up. You may stay up. As many, many parents do. Perhaps not in that exactly way, but they back down. Go to bed. All very fierce and stern. Bedtime now. The child screams. And the parent carries on doing whatever they were doing before, which is in fact saying, okay, you're right. I have no right to tell you to go to bed. You can stay up as long as you want. That's a terribly insecure feeling for a child. And I have a parent who doesn't know clearly what he wants, doesn't know what he wants for me or of me, is unable to communicate it to me, and hasn't got the guts to insist. And if I, little so-and-so, three years older than me, am a threat to my father, what are other people to him? How does he stand up to the adult world? He must be completely incapable of doing so. And the child starts losing confidence in the parent. And the whole parent-child relationship cracks up. And the same situation you have in the husband-wife situation. Between two people, there can be three types of relationship. Companions, husband-wife, so father-daughter, or parent-child, or child-parent. In the husband-wife relationship, theoretically you should be able to have two companions, or a father-daughter relationship, or a mother-son relationship. So those are the only three combinations that are possible. A companion relationship doesn't exist in marriage. It's not a successful marriage, and it really exists. It's usually a father-daughter or a mother-son. Sometimes it's both. Sometimes it switches from one to the other, depending on the security and insecurity of both parties. But the Gemara says, and this is the basis of the whole thing, that a healthy marriage is a father-daughter relationship. Not that one becomes a father, but that's in terms of the comparisons which I've given you, it's a father-daughter relationship. Gemara says that anybody who marries a woman, ke'ilu yelada, it's as if you gave birth to that woman, it's as if she's your child. And that's the relationship. When you've taken total responsibility for a girl, you're that girl's parent now, you're that girl's father. And that's the kind of relationship. Obviously it has many other ramifications, and the sexual relationship is different, and the emotional relationship is different, obviously. But in terms of equal this way, or balance this way, or that way, the relationship is meant to be a father-daughter relationship. And just as a father who tells a daughter to go to bed and the daughter says no and the father backs down, so a husband who tells a wife what to do and the wife says no and he backs down and that's the end of it, she begins to lose confidence in him. And the women's lib movement was a demonstration of the woman's loss of confidence in the man, and with full justification. They were proved right by the fact that men just cleared out of the way as the women's lib movement came marching along. And there's now quite a big anti-women's lib movement. Quite a big movement back again to tell the women, you're not going to find your fulfillment by imitating a man. You're going to find your fulfillment by understanding your femininity, following your femininity, and practicing and expressing yourself within that femininity. But that shouldn't have come from women themselves. When the women's lib movement started, its destruction, so to say, should have come from the men. And that would have given the woman a feeling of reinstated confidence in her men folk, which she still was not able to receive. So if a woman doesn't admire her husband when he tells her what to do, she thinks it's a downright chutzpah. And she'll do it only under duress and pressure. So there are now two options. He says, we're going out tonight. We're going to see a play tonight. Whether he says it in that way, or he says it more politely or not, doesn't make terribly much difference. Or he says, we're going on holiday next week, or he says, we're not going on holiday because we can't afford it. And she says, yeah, yes, we are, and so on. And he says, no, we're not. She turns around to him and thinks to herself, who are you? I earn most of the money around here, coming to that, or part of the money around here. I'm the one who slaves. I'm the one who works. Who are you to tell me we're not taking a holiday next week? So what has the husband got to do? He's either got to back off and say, well, okay, if you're so upset about it, we'll go. In which case, she loses confidence in his judgment, and next time round, the same episode will occur, perhaps on a more serious issue. Or he has to insist. If he insists, he's terrorizing her. She doesn't have a natural desire to to listen to him, to obey him.
But if you act as a father-daughter relationship, you are in fact terrorizing. What I see that you're presenting, which is a
it's horrible what I'm presenting, isn't it? Yeah.
I don't think it's horrible enough or relevant. You make your own value judgment. But it's what many sociologists do. You set these little, you know, patterns that are great, you know, in theory on paper, but hardly in realism. I mean, the husband would come and say, gee, I work so hard, so I have the right to choose who's going to go where. And they're so busy playing these games, and even if in fact they do work, I'm not saying they can't work, they do work, there's little time to develop love and respect because everybody's playing these games all the time.
Isn't that good? It becomes a natural relationship. It becomes an absolutely natural relationship for people who've trained for it. But we'll come to that still a little bit later. The next thing is obviously if there's no admiration, then his giving becomes valueless. To receive something from somebody you don't respect. So what's the gift worth? It's worth its monetary value. If he gives you a sixpence, it's worth a sixpence. If he gives you R100, it's worth R100. And if he gives you a kiss, probably worth nothing. from a man whom a woman doesn't respect. From a man whom a woman doesn't admire. The giving starts losing its value. It has only material value, and she begins to demand material giving because that's the only form of giving which has some value. At least material giving has a rands and cents value to it. Whereas emotional giving has no value to her whatever, and as we'll see later on, sexual giving has very little meaning to her once that admiration is lost. And sensitivity obviously doesn't exist if she doesn't admire him. It's clear that he isn't able to understand her functioning. This admiration that we're talking about is an admiration which has to be cultivated. It's not an admiration which can be insisted upon. You shall admire me. That is my right that you shall admire me. It just doesn't work like that. That's not admiration. And it's not something which comes overnight. Thank God people fall in love. And during that time she admires him. Now he has to work very quickly to make sure that when they fall out of love, which doesn't take very long, when they fall out of love, there's admiration left. And from that admiration on her side and the various elements that we've discussed, the responsibility on his side, they will be able to start structuring, not falling in love, but rising in love, which is a different thing altogether. Falling in love happens very suddenly, and one can get hurt by it too, and one falls out just as quickly. But he's got a short period while that infatuation is continuing, and it's only for a few weeks or months at most after marriage. During that period, he can establish himself as a man worthy of her admiration. If he doesn't, it becomes much later, much more difficult later on. Once she's lost her admiration for him, it obviously becomes much more difficult for him to re-establish it. He has to establish it through his sensitivity. He's got to be able to show her that he really understands and really cares for her. Real care. If she begins to feel that it's artificial and that it's put on, that just doesn't wash any water at all. It's meaningless to her. And she sees through it right away. In order to admire her husband, she's got to feel that he is sensitive to her needs, that he understands her as a woman, and that he understands her as an individual, and that he cares about her thoroughly. As far as the imposition is concerned, the imposition has to be based on knowledge and on wisdom. The imposition can't just be, you know, okay, now it's my right to impose, I'll impose this, that and the other. We'll stand on our head for 5 minutes every morning and we'll run around the block every evening and he starts imposing a whole lot of ridiculous disciplines which have no meaning and she sees through it right away. It has to be based on his knowledge of what he's doing. When he imposes something, he's got to know that it's right and he's got to transmit that knowledge to her and she's got to see, if not immediately, but then later on in the marriage, that he was right in fact. You can't afford too many mistakes. A husband who imposes his will and she fights against it and loses and does what he wants to, and afterwards he's proved wrong, then depending how he handles that mistake, he might come out and say, sorry, I was wrong. I should have followed you. Next time round, there are not that many times that the marriage can take the man making a mistake. It's like a business. How many times can a business tolerate a managing director who makes wrong business decisions at every turn? He gets sacked after a while, or the business goes bust. And a family where the husband is constantly taking the wrong decisions and imposing the wrong disciplines and the wrong value systems, and the wife is constantly picking it up and being proved or feels intuitively right all the time, steadily, steadily her confidence in him is diminished and the admiration starts to disappear. And lastly, on the giving side, of course, the giving has to be giving and not bribing. She's got to feel that it's out of a need of his to give to her and a desire of his to give to her. Not because he wants something in return and is bargaining with her. That's not what it is. I love you so that you'll love me back one day. That's not what it is. It's I love you no matter what, and I don't care whether you love me or not, I still love you. That's the kind of giving that she's got to feel. If she starts feeling a conditional love, I love you sometimes, I love you if you're good, I love you if you do what I tell you, that's not a man. A man is, you will do what I tell you, because that's the kind of relationship we have, and I will love you even if you wouldn't do what I tell you. I need to love you. I don't have anybody else that I can give and express my full love to. That's why I chose you. You are the condition for the fulfillment of my love. That's where it ends. And if that's what she feels, then she feels in safe hands. So she's got a husband who understands her. She's got a husband who cares about her. She's got a husband who has knowledge and wisdom. You might say we're asking for a tall order and that it's very theoretical and not all that practical, but we'll still see that it's not all that theoretical and it's quite practical. It's demanding. I don't deny that it's demanding. She's got a husband who knows what he's doing, who has knowledge, and who has wisdom. Wisdom is the ability to apply the knowledge accurately. Doesn't help having academic knowledge, which when you apply, you make a mess of. So both he has the knowledge and the wisdom, the ability to apply it wisely. And he's a husband who loves her, who's giving to her. That's a man she admires. And if you watch all these surveys on sex appeal and so on, and all these film stars when they do these surveys in women's magazines to see who has the most sex appeal, these are the elements that they look for. An independence in a man who wants to give and doesn't need to take the love. A man who has knowledge and wisdom of some sort or another, an ability in whose hands she feels secure. And a man who shows a degree of understanding. If she admires him in this way, then she wants him to be the rabbi in the home. She wants him to guide the home. And he must understand that he's got to paskin, as a rabbi does. He's got to take decisions and explain those decisions. A rabbi doesn't impose without explaining. He explains to anybody who cares to listen. And a husband too. He mustn't treat his wife like somebody incapable of understanding his reasoning. He has to sit down with her where necessary and explain how he came to that and why he came to that. But not negotiate. There's a big difference between explaining and negotiating. A husband who won't explain is a tyrant. He's a small, insecure man that has to express his manlyhood by imposing himself on his wife. A man who negotiates is a weakling. One needs to be a man who's able to decide, explain, and put it down. That's how it is. She has the choice to marry him or not to marry him. She can try and change his mind. But on matters of the direction of the home, she has no choice. The husband chooses the direction. Yeah. More than that, he's got to give what would otherwise be a drab existence. And this is another problem in a marriage, that a woman's existence, if she is in the home, if she isn't working, and even if she's working, since her work comes second, her existence can become pretty drab. Changing the children and cleaning the house and cooking the food, it's not terribly spiritual and not terribly exciting. And he has to introduce spirituality into the house. He's got to make her feel that this is all worthwhile, that it's all building towards something, that it's all meaningful, that it's not just cooking food which gets eaten and changing nappies which have to be changed again in a few hours' time and cleaning a house which gets dirty again tomorrow. She's got to feel that it's all going somewhere, that it's worthwhile, that she's serving a higher purpose than just being a maidservant. So she needs her husband, in addition to the qualities we've discussed above, to be introducing spirituality into the house. And by spirituality, I don't mean religion. I mean spirituality, meaning, into the home. She can't do that easily. She can express the meaning. She can give life to the meaning. But he must instill that meaning into the home. He's got to teach the participants in the home experiment the meaningfulness of what they're doing. Now the difficulty as far as the woman is concerned, but it's not that difficult if everything up till now is followed. The difficulty as far as the woman is concerned is treating her husband like a king. And she has to treat him like a king. Because he is a king in the home. And because that's the whole relationship that we've developed. If she does admire him more than any other man, which is what she should be doing, then he is a king for her. He is for her the most ultimate. Doesn't mean that he is the most brilliant man she ever knew. She might know more brilliant men. It doesn't mean that he's the handsomest man. She might be quite willing to admit that there are many men in the world more handsome than her own husband. But she must feel that she's the only, that he is the only man that she can admire, taking his total personality into account, that she can admire to such a degree. There's nobody that she can admire more than her husband. That's a tall order for a woman. It's terribly demanding for a woman that she has to have that feeling. But it's demanding on the man. The man has to be able to create in his wife those feelings of admiration. That's where it is. And if he can't, that's where the failure starts. He's unable to conquer his wife. Conquering a wife is not just the ability to climb into bed with her and make her happy. That an animal can do. Exactly as you've got that on a sexual level. A husband has to be able to conquer his wife's admiration and commitment. And that's a process of conquest. It's not something which can be demanded. And it's not something which is instant. It's something which has to be worked on over years and years of self-development. If she treats him like a king, not only does it make her happy, but it also ensures his male potency. And again, I'm not talking on a physiological level, or shall I say, I'm not talking on a physiological level only, but it asserts his emotional potency. It helps him do all the things we've just been discussing that he has to do. After all, she treats him like a king, so he feels like a king. Feeling like a king, he feels it's more important still for him to make wise decisions. So he puts more effort into his decisions. He doesn't say things that he hasn't thought about carefully. When he said them, he puts them over as carefully as he can. He develops a certain confidence. This newfound confidence and newly developed knowledge enables her to admire him still more. And she does admire him still more, and she expresses that admiration still more, which makes him feel even more regal in his new situation, more self-confident, more proud, and so the marriage takes on a new dynamicism. One thing leading to the next and ensuring happiness. But this is it has to work on these steps. He's got to start. She's got to be able to respond with admiration. And he will take that admiration and use that to build himself up to somebody even more worthy of her admiration, who will in turn command still more admiration. And so it develops. She must never, even in an argument, in a fight or anything, belittle his masculinity. She must never criticize him in a way which makes him feel ois man. That not. She's got to ensure that if she wants to criticize, she can criticize. If she wants to be nasty, there's a time to be nasty too, and she sometimes has to be nasty. But not in that area. Just as we said, never humiliate a wife. You can do all sorts of things, but never humiliate her, particularly in front of others. And most particularly in front of your own parents. Never, ever, ever do that. So a wife must never, ever make a husband feel inadequate as a man. Because that too can be very dangerous and unfortunate. Torah etiquette is different from Western etiquette. A man goes first in Torah etiquette. Man walks before the wife. The little door, the man goes in first. That's part of this whole relationship. It might be a very nice gesture for the husband to stand aside and invite his wife in first. I mean, that would be the ultimate. But her assumption has to be that he goes in first. He's the king. And just as Lady Diana is going to have to walk one pace behind her husband wherever she goes, even though she'll be a queen, that doesn't matter. A queen walks one pace behind the king. I don't say that a wife has to walk a pace behind the husband, but when there's only one door, a door wide enough for only one person to enter, the king goes first. She derives her honor from being the wife of a king. That's what makes her feel good. She's the wife of a man she admires more than anybody else, but then admire him and treat him like a king. Otherwise, he won't feel like a king and you won't feel you're married to a king. And when you no longer feel you're married to a king, the whole relationship starts disintegrating. So it's on the woman to ensure, once the man has the basic requirements for admiration, she's got to preserve that admiration by treating him with that admiration. But it looks very ridiculous for an outstanding girl to treat a real shlemiel like a king. And a man has to be careful who he marries, that a shlemiel doesn't marry an outstanding girl. And it happens very often. Or shall we say, an outstanding girl should be careful not to marry a shlemiel. And if he is a shlemiel, he better start working on himself quickly. Because we Jews don't believe that a man is incapable of improving himself and changing his whole character. Not his personality, we can't change personality. But character can be changed beyond recognition in a relatively short time. It's hard, it's demanding, but it can be done. Like the Shlumil is married to an outstanding girl, he's got to start working jolly hard. Otherwise that marriage will crack. Giving you an example of the differences. Once we've established this kind of relationship, and I think now you can begin to see the three lectures in their context. The first, the second, and tonight. Now we're just beginning to round the circle off. To give you an example, the difference between a request and an instruction. One can ask for something to be done in two different ways. One can order it and one can request it. Which is the correct way for a husband? Which is the correct way for a wife? A request means do it because I want it. An order means, an instruction, is do it because it's right. That's the first difference. A request is, look, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but please do it for me. That's a request. An instruction is, don't worry about me, you do it. It has to be done. Maybe it has to be done because I'm telling you to do it. If the Prime Minister tells somebody to do something, a king, an emperor tells somebody to do something, irrespective of whether the thing is right or wrong, it has to be done. I'm not talking about where it's immoral. It has to be done because the king said so. And in fact, even where it's immoral, it has to be done. The only reason that according to Jewish law you don't do it, if a king asks you to do something immoral, is because the King of Kings said don't. A more superior authority. But theoretically, if a king tells you to do something, it needs to be done. Either because it's right, or because it is right to obey a king. That is also right. It is right to obey a teacher. It is right to obey the Prime Minister, and it is right to obey your husband. Therefore, if a husband wants something done, and he orders it, not in an unpleasant and insensitive way, obviously, but that it's more an order than a request, does that contradict his role in terms of the marriage that we've described? Not at all. He's worked it out. It needs to be done. It should be done. And he puts it across as an instruction. A request is put across as something I want because I want it. When you fulfill a request, I come to you and I say, please do me a favor and X, Y, Z. And you do it. Are you a giver or a taker by doing it? You're a giver. I need something and you have fulfilled my need. So if a wife requests something, it's perfectly in keeping with the whole marital relationship. She requests something, giving her husband the opportunity to give to her by fulfilling the request. And that's fine. So when she wants a glass of water or a cup of tea, she mustn't say, darling, bring me a cup of tea. She must say, you know, I'm so thirsty. That would be so nice if we had a cup of tea together. Don't you think that would be lovely? Do you think you could? If it's too difficult for you, I'll go and get the cup of tea. She must always say, she's always offer. So if it's too difficult for you, don't worry, I'll get it for myself. I just need a cup of tea to give him the opportunity at least to say, don't worry, my darling, I will get it for you. The big hero has now got the opportunity to do something for his wife, and he's showing his extreme sensitivity for her, that he is responding to her in her time of need. By the way, when the Gemara says that you must love your wife as you love yourself, that means that just as when you're thirsty, as a reflex action you go to the tap or to the kitchen to get a cup of tea. Reflex. So you should be tuned into your wife. And there should be a similar reflex. That's what loving a wife like yourself means. Not just to be able to figure out her needs, but her needs should be like your needs. And the reaction should be virtually reflex. That's what it means. Ohavo kegufo. You've got to love her like you love your own body. And respond to her like you respond to yourself. That's really what love means when it comes to love. That's the test of love. But let's say he isn't quite on that level of love, as most men aren't. Then she's got to request it in a way that leaves him the giver. A husband. Please, my darling, I feel so thirsty. Little Baba talking to mommy again. Please, I need it. Bring me a cup of tea. That's not the way. It's an instruction. Again, not coarsely and insensitively, but come on, darling, let's have a cup of tea now. It's a different thing altogether. And when she does it, and when she goes to the kitchen and brings the cup of tea, is she giving or receiving? Depends on his stature. If he's a man that she admires, she is receiving. That's the biggest honor. The king comes and phones you up and says, come round to my place this evening and bring me such and such. Oh, it's fantastic. You'll give up anything to go to Buckingham Palace and give him what he needs. And you don't even expect him to say thank you. Not necessary. It's not polite for a husband not to say thank you, but it's not something that you need. It's basically, if the husband has the stature and is commanding the respect and admiration which we're talking about, she loves to do what he wants. As long as she knows what he wants, as long as he'll tell her what she wants. Doing what he wants is a source of fulfillment. And in fact, it's an act of giving, not an act. It's an act of receiving, not an act of giving. That's why we talk about a mitzvah. What does it mean, a mitzvah? Things that it's good for us to do. We get more out of doing mitzvahs than we give, obviously. And that's how the whole religion is based on the importance to us of doing mitzvahs. But what does mitzvah mean? Instruction, commandment. A commandment from God is something we get more out of doing than God gets. And a husband who's admired and respected by his wife gets less when she fulfills his instruction than she does herself. She gets much more fulfillment and much more enjoyment if she feels that she is fulfilling his needs, that she's serving him, not in a humiliating way, I mean serving him in terms of the relationship being a good one, that she's able to function as a wife whom he appreciates, and he in turn will show the appreciation, because he doesn't like to be a receiver, don't forget, and will show his extreme appreciation for everything she's done, and will carry on ordering her around the next day, and she'll love it. That's fine. The same relationship exists in the raising of children. A wife, a mother, can go to a child and say, please, my darling, I've had such a hard day, do me a favor and just for 5 minutes stop nagging me and let me have a minute's rest. Please do it for me. Have mercy on me. And the child will respond to that. The child feels big. He's responding. His mother needs peace. And he, the big child, is going to ensure that his mother gets that peace. Right? That's an unspoiled child. But if the father comes back and please, and gets on his hands and knees to the little kid, that doesn't work at all. The father instructs, a mother can request. There are times when she instructs too, but it's not harmful to her relationship with her child if she requests, whereas it very often is if she instructs. And as far as the father is concerned, it's not harmful for a father to instruct, but it is harmful for a father to request. Father is the authority in the home, you instruct. Kid is in your home. You, the father and husband, it is your home. You are responsible for it. You are the managing director of that household. And the kid is there at your tolerance and sufferance. And he jolly well subscribes to the rules you lay down for as long as he's dwelling there, no matter how old he is. And there's no need to give in, provided one has the stature and the wisdom and the sensitivity, etc., etc., that the kid doesn't feel he's being stood upon by a father who doesn't understand him. Of course, it's a tall order. Gentleness is very much a feminine quality. It's part of her femininity, and it's terribly positive. Gentleness in a husband is not necessarily a good quality. I'm talking about gentleness as opposed to sensitivity. We're not talking about sensitivity and understanding. We're talking about gentleness. Gentleness is often just a cover-up for weakness and for lack of confidence. And that a husband mustn't show and mustn't act in that particular way. I remember just before I gave the last marriage series, we went to the game reserve. We saw some interesting things. That I was talking to an old Afrikaans farmer at one of the camps, and we were just comparing what we'd seen, and he's been to the game reserve every year for 50 years, twice a year I think it was. And he said, but never in all his life until the day before did he have the opportunity of watching a lion, husband and wife, playing together as they would in their bedroom, so to say. Just having fun together, playing with each other and so on. And he described it to me, and it sounded very interesting. It sounded like an interesting study altogether. And he said, that one doesn't see because they don't play that way on the side of the road. So I prayed to the Ribbono Shel'olam that I too should be able to see the sight and should not be treated any less kindly than the Afrikaans farmer to whom I spoke. And God, as he often does, listened to my prayers. And next morning we were driving out of Satara, and just down the road he stopped, Sorry, it wasn't just down the road. It was after many hours of very frustrating, sightless driving. The Ribbono Shel'olam was prepared to grant my wish, but only with sufficient ishtadlus, with sufficient effort on my part. And there we came across the lions we were looking for. A man lion and his vafi. And they were playing. And we watched this very interestingly, particularly because I was busy preparing the series of lectures. Number one, in their playfulness, he treated her like absolute dirt. And she loved it. But the moment there was a sound a distance away, the whole relationship changed. He took command, he stood up, took command, and was obviously ordering her around and positioning her, and then his other wives started appearing and he positioned them. The whole, all of the authority was there. And then I understood why she loved being treated like dirt by him, because he was a king. He had the stature, he had the control. She knew who she was being treated by like dirt. And once it's a king that's treating you anyway, as long as he's treating you particularly like dirt, because then it's intimate. She was able to handle. She started bossing him around a little bit and slapping his face a little bit, and he tolerated it, he put up with it. But again, only because at any moment he could take command. He wasn't gentle with her in playing with her. She was gentle with him in playing with him. That was the relationship. Sensitivity, yes, on the part of a man, of course. Gentleness of a type, yes, but not gentleness which is just a cover up for lack of confidence and for weakness. A woman likes to feel that she's got a real husband who's real physically and real emotionally and real mentally, who has views, who has ideas, who believes in them, who can put them into practice, who gets angry if they're not put into practice, who has demands. She needs to feel the pressure of a husband living with her. And not just to feel that she's next to some polite kind of creature who, as long as she keeps out of his way, doesn't make life intolerable for her. In all this, obviously, what you've been worried about is that we're aiming for something unachievable. And it's not really. We're talking about an education factor. We're talking about two human beings being mentioned before they come to the marriage. Not coming to the marriage as immature, uneducated little children, expecting overnight to mature and to become educated. And I don't talk of education in terms of school education. I talk of education in terms of real education. Being educated to be a human being. And unfortunately, there's very little of that education being taught in homes or in schools or universities. That's just not what people are teaching now. It's not the fashion. All the teachers don't know how to teach it. But that's the education that a person needs before they come to marriage. Marriage is natural. Everybody has an intuition how to run a marriage. God wouldn't have created marriage as something which you need to go to university before you can understand how to operate it. Marriage is something which a husband and wife can intuitively make work without any effort. Like the bringing up of children, by the way. Children don't have to be brought up. They just have to be given the environment in which to grow and to flower. They don't have to be brought up. Leave them alone. They'll bring themselves up very nicely. So a marriage doesn't have to be interfered with and manipulated and talked about and contrived and have marriage enrichment courses that shouldn't need that. Marriage is a perfectly natural method of man and woman, husband and wife, living together as they were meant to live together in one unit. And just as you don't have to be taught how to live yourself, you have a natural instinct of self-survival, I'm talking about physical survival, so a husband and wife should not need to be taught how to live together. Provided when they come together, he is a man and a mensch, and she is a woman and a mensch. Then they can come together and use their natural intuition to make their marriages flower. What I've been trying to show you so far is that the problems in marriage are not marital problems. They're a husband's problems, his own problems. That's why it's not working. He doesn't know how to be a mensch. He doesn't know what giving is. He doesn't know what caring is. He doesn't know what sensitivity is. He doesn't have enough self-confidence to impose a system on his wife, because he doesn't have a system that he believes in. He doesn't know how to give, he doesn't know how to love, because he was spoiled as a child. Love was never demanded of him. Love was only showered upon him. And so he goes into the marriage needing love, and she goes into the marriage needing love, and as we said last week, there's nobody to do the loving. They both need. And they both get frustrated with one another because they're unable to fulfill one another. But the problem is not a marital problem. It's that he is not an educated man and she is not an educated woman. He needs to be educated in character. If she's going to admire him, and we've shown how essential her admiration of him is, he needs to be a man of character who has principles and will stand up for those principles and will make himself unpopular for those principles and will make sacrifices for those principles. And he's not a little jellyfish of a guy that he's got principles, but if it's a bit difficult, he's got other principles and he can work and it's not so important. And nothing's terribly important. Nothing's worth staking your life on. Nothing's worth standing up and fighting for. A wife doesn't like to be married to a husband who isn't a warrior. And being a warrior is part of male sex appeal. But a warrior doesn't mean that you have to go out there shooting people and killing people. A warrior means that you're prepared to fight. That you're able to fight and that you have something to fight for. But a man who goes into a marriage with nothing is prepared to fight for. Who is she married to? What kind of a guy? Why should she admire him? What is there to admire about him? That he's handsome? That he can speak sweetly? What is it that he really stands up for? Well, who is he? And that's what she begins to question later on in the marriage. Who is he? At what point will he say no? At what point will he fight? At what point will he stake the marriage? At what point will he stake his life? And if she feels, as she comes to each question, at no point, at no point, at no point, then she realizes she's married to a little guy who doesn't believe in anything and isn't capable or prepared to fight for anything. And the respect goes. So a man's character has to be cultivated, preferably before marriage. But it's never too late. As long as a man is alive, before his death, even if he's only got a few minutes to live still, as long as he's living, all this can be done. I say again, most emphatically, that Judaism would not exist if we didn't believe that man was capable of developing character. That's what the Torah is all about. That's what Judaism is all about. That is the whole religion, is the ability and the method of a human being to develop character. And a man who's involved in Yiddishkeit and isn't developing character and isn't growing in that way is involved in totally the wrong way. He's doing the wrong things and he's under the wrong guidance. That's what has to be happening in a Jewish process of involvement. The development of character. The acquisition of principles to fight for and the ability to fight for those principles. Real principles that he believes in, that he understands and that he feels for. He must have emotional independence in order to be able to give. A husband who is not emotionally independent is not going to be able to give. He's going to need to receive. He's going to need to be loved rather than to love. That's part of the character building. A man has to have sufficient self-image, sufficient inner dynamicism, sufficient emotional health, sufficient intelligence to be independent emotionally so that he can be a giver, a father, a husband, somebody who gives, somebody who's overflowing with emotion rather than an empty barrel that needs to be filled constantly, and as you fill it, so it runs out because it's so empty and it's so dry. A husband has to overflow with emotion, overflow with understanding, overflow with love. And preferably he should be that way before he's married. And if he's not that way, he's dissipated. And that can't establish a healthy marriage. And if he isn't like that before a marriage, I say again, it can be done later. But it can't be done overnight. We're talking about a long process of self-education. We're talking about somebody who hasn't already done it. We're talking about a 5 to 10 year program. It's not an overnight thing. It's an educational program that a person has to embark on. We're talking about sensitivity and understanding. If he doesn't have it before he's gotten married, he should have it. The education he's followed should have been one which has taught him to understand people, to be sensitive to people, to respond to people, most important of all. That's something which Yiddishkeit trains a child from early childhood. How to notice, how to care, and how to respond. And if he hasn't been through that process of education, there was a time when universities used to teach that too, by the way. When people used to study classics and they used to be educated, and before universities became technical colleges, people used to be relatively educated when they came out of university. Now it's a fallacy. People go to university to be educated and they come out getting married and going into the big wide world as if they really are educated. And they're not. They're barbarian. We don't realize that you can come out of a university education with a PhD and be a barbarian. Insensitive. Uncultured. Not understanding of anything of the fine things in life. Not understanding of other people's feelings. And of how to respond to them. Unable to give. Unable to be emotional at all. Unable to stand up for a principle. What's there sophisticated and educated about such a man? And if he goes into the marriage like that, he has to at least ensure that he doesn't stay in the marriage in that, like that, and that he educates himself later on in his life, when he's 25 or 35 or 45 or 55 or 65. It makes no difference. There comes a time when a man has to face up to it. I'm uneducated, and I need to educate myself if I want my marriage to last, quite apart from all the other reasons for which a man needs an education. And lastly, and most important, knowledge. If he's going to impose a system, if he's going to follow a system, if he's going to apply, if he's going to fight for certain things and stand for certain things, he needs to know what he's doing. He needs to be sure he's right. You can't afford to make too many mistakes. He needs to study morality. Literally, to study morality. He needs to study what is right and what is wrong. Why it's right and why it's wrong. A husband has to be able to explain to his wife why we can't do that. He can't just say it's just not done, or I don't want it. He's got to have the knowledge to be sure he's right, it isn't done and won't be done, and this is why it won't be done. Remember I said we've got to explain, not negotiate, but explain. But he has to have the knowledge in order to explain. He has to study what is true and what is false. What constitutes truth, what constitutes falsehood. He has to understand morality. I'll give you an example that happened to me just this afternoon in Cape Town when we were discussing some business matters with a man who told me he has an amazing problem with his children. They've gone out onto the border and they're being taught to kill. And they're coming back insensitive and they'll be coming back from the border destroyed human beings. And I said, that's your fault. Before your child went to the border, you should have taught your child that he wasn't going to kill. He was going to defend you. He was going to make sure that those people that he's busy killing don't penetrate into the cities and kill our wives and children. There's different ways of looking at it. Is he killing or is he saving? Is he destroying life or is he saving life? But that needs to be studied and defined. Sometimes one needs to kill and it's not called murder. And sometimes killing is called murder. And there's sometimes a hairline's breadth in between them. And a husband needs to know that hairline's breadth. When killing is defending and when killing is murder. When talking Lashon Hara, talking bad about somebody is defending, saving somebody from somebody else's malice, and when it is malicious. He's got to be able to explain the difference and say, that kind of Lashon Hara we don't speak. And there might be another time when you need to speak it. But then he has to know the principles of Lashon Hara. What constitutes malicious talk about other people? What is maliciousness? When is it malicious? When isn't it malicious? When is it constructive? When is it destructive? And when it's constructive, how do you do it? To make it as constructive as possible and as little destructive as possible. This is instilling spiritual and emotional content into a life. This is making a home and a life worthwhile. And he stands up for these principles because he believes in them and he understands them. But that needs learning, that needs knowledge. And if, as is usually the case, one comes into the marriage without that knowledge has to be started to be gained. And I say again, I'm not one for instant education, I'm not one for instant anything. I don't like instant coffee and I don't like instant education. Anything that's good and anything that's worthwhile takes a long time to cultivate. We're talking about 5, 10, 15 years before one really starts reaping the benefits of such a program of education. And she, the lady, has to be taught how to give admiration. She has to be taught how to respect. It sounds weird, doesn't it, saying such words? I can almost hardly believe that I'm saying such a thing. But it's so true. We've lost the ability to respect, to show honor. There used to be a time when honor was just part of normal politeness. That's how people related to one another. That's all gone. Honor is now old-fashioned. And we have to be taught, particularly our women folk, have to be taught how to notice qualities worthy of admiration and how to admire, how to express admiration. You don't have to teach your daughters how to love. They know how to love. You do have to teach them how to admire and what to admire. Perhaps even more important. Too late when she wants to get married and you say, what do you see in him? He's a real nobody. That's too late. You, the one who gave her, your daughter, the system of admiration, what to admire and what not to admire. And it's in the early years that one has to teach her that kind of value system. What to admire and then how you show admiration. And how you show to admiration to somebody you're living with. To show admiration to a king that you see once in a lifetime if you're lucky. Or to show admiration to a pop star that you only see on a television screen and you don't see how he behaves with his wife and kids, all that is easy. To show admiration to your wife, to your husband, to your parents, to your children, to your brothers and sisters, to your close friends, to your business colleagues, to the people you see every day and the people who get on your nerves every day. To be able to show admiration to those people because they're people, because they're created by God, because they're intelligent and they have souls and spirits, and because you love them and because you really admire them. Very often a wife does admire her husband but just doesn't know how to consistently show that admiration, and it has to be consistent. I want to read to you a piece of Maimonides, a piece of the Rambam. Now this is the Rambam's book of laws, not the Rambam's book of philosophy. He wrote a book of philosophy and he wrote a book of law. This is in his book of law. In the 15th perek of Hilchot Ishut, towards the end, you'll now understand the Rambam, because what I've given you in these last three shirim is basically what the Rambam says in a few lines. V'chova al kol ish, it is an obligation on every man, it is a duty. And this is the book of law, this is his legal business. And he starts, notice, with the man's obligation. Lekanot li ishto, he has got to be passionately in love with his wife. It is an obligation, it is a duty. Strange duty, but it is. Amru chachomim, our wise people said, Ein adam mekanei li ishto, elaim kein nichnetza bo ruach tahara. A man is only in love with his wife if he has a degree of spiritual purity. When one doesn't have spiritual purity, one's in love with all sorts of other people's wives. But to be in love with one's own wife and to consistently be in love with one's own wife, for that you need to be a man with spiritual purity. How much in love must you be? Says the Rambam, not so much that you rape her. That's how far it goes. One has to be able to control one's love. But one sees the type, the level of love we're talking about. The degree of passion that a man is instructed to feel for his wife. And that's where it starts. If he doesn't have that, this is part of our whole first section. The whole question of him being the giver rather than the taker, the lover rather than the loved. Having a degree of stature and so on. How does the wife respond to that? She responds to that with modesty. Now we're going to still discuss modesty in the future. It's not modesty in the English sense at all. Tzniut is a different concept altogether. All I want to point out now is that a woman cannot respond with tzniut, with real tzniut, if she doubts her husband's affection. If she's worried that her husband is not being affectionate, then she's either going to break the boundaries of tzniut in her relationship to her own husband or in relationship to other men. But she's going to want to feel loved. She's going to want to feel that there's some man around who cares for her. And she's either going to break the boundaries of tzniut to make sure that he cares for her or that somebody else does. And then again you have a breakdown. But if she feels so confident in his love, because she feels it all the time, he's brimming, he's overflowing with love, then she can be a modest woman. And again, please don't, we don't have a chance to define modesty now, but please don't think it's anything like modesty. It's another concept altogether. It's romance. That's really what it is. You'll see next week. It's basically romance. She can behave romantically if she's sure her husband loves her. Because romance means subtlety, being subtle. And a woman who's not sure that her husband really loves her won't take the risk of being subtle because he probably won't notice. And she'll have to start being more than subtle, and then she starts losing a lot of her feminine attractiveness if she's not subtle. So she can only retain her feminine subtlety if she's confident in his love. V'chein, each paragraph he starts with a v'chein, and so the one leads on to the other. Back to the man. A man must then honor his wife more than he honors himself and love her as much as he loves himself. And if he's got money, he should spend it on her. And he shouldn't instill a fear into her. And he should always speak nicely to her. This is a book of Jewish law. It's the same Rambam that writes that you've got to keep kashrus, and you've got to keep Shabbos, and you've got to keep this, and you've got to keep that. It's the same law. He must always speak nicely to her. Firmly, but nicely. No interpretations. There are no interpretations. No discussions. It's clear. V'yeyeh diburo imar benachat. And he shall speak to her in a pleasant way. So believe me, there are not two interpretations as to what that means. Velo yeh atzev, and he is not permitted to get depressed. Velo ragzan, and he is not permitted to get angry. A wife does get depressed, and a wife can get angry, because she's much more susceptible to the influences around her. A husband should be capable of controlling his passions, of retaining a certain insulation from the battering storms around and about him. And a wife needs to feel that confidence in him, that he can stand up straight no matter how strong the wind is. And for him just to get miserable because he had a bad day, that's what a woman does. A woman gets miserable because she had a bad day and she needs support from her husband. But a husband is not permitted to. That's not a husband of stature. If he's incapable of controlling his own emotions, again, that's a fundamental principle in Torah education, the ability to raise oneself above the influences around and about one, the emotional influences around and about one. Not just to get miserable because you had a bad day or because somebody said something to you. You're not permitted to show your misery or to feel miserable. And you're not permitted to get angry. You're permitted to pretend to be angry, the Rambam says in another place. Sometimes one has to feign anger. But not to really lose one's temper. A man is not permitted to lose his temper. What do you want to ask?
No, this seems just totally inconsistent. How can one be that neutral and be that passionate?
He doesn't say neutral at all.
No,
he just says don't get depressed.
He can't get depressed, he can't get angry.
Well, I don't call a man who's not depressed neutral. I call him healthy. It's a different word altogether. And a healthy man can be passionate too.
No, but that's not what you're saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
What would you call him if he's never depressed and he's never angry? What would he be?
A very healthy human being.
No, but what would that be? Define it as you would healthy, angry or sad.
How do you mean? How would he be feeling?
Yeah. Right.
He is able to feel happy. He is able to feel balanced. He is able to feel whatever it is. But he doesn't get into a state, into a fit, which is uncontrollable. And depression becomes uncontrollable, and anger becomes uncontrollable. With all other emotions, you can continue to live normally. When you lose your temper, you behave like a madman. And when you get depressed, you behave like a madman as well. And one isn't permitted to be a madman. A woman sometimes can't help it because of the pressures around and about her. But a man must be able to stand up to those pressures.
Could you explain spirituality?
I think it will come out as we go along still. Spirituality is the living according to meaning and living for something more worthwhile than just the little petty things that go on around and about us.
V'chein.
Sure, it includes religion, but it's not only religion. V'chein tzivu al ha'ishon. The last one says the Rambam. Shetiyeh mechabedet. Listen to this carefully, because just as the key is with the man, that's where it starts, so it ends with a woman, that round of the circle, and she's got to finish it off, otherwise the dynamics break up. That she honors her husband beyoter midai, more than he needs. Don't give him as much honor as you think he deserves. Give him more. That's how it'll work. V'yiyeh aleha moira mimenu, and she should not fear him, but have him, hold him in awe. Hold him. I use the word admiration. It's more than admiration. Yiro is the same term we use about our relationship to God. So hold him in absolute awe. V'ta'ase kol ma'aseha al piv, and everything she does should be by his instruction. Not necessarily an active instruction, even a tacit instruction. She knows what he wants. She adjusts her life according to his desires. And she must understand when she's getting married that that's what she's doing. And he should be in her eyes like a prince or like a king. That's when the marriage can start becoming romantic. Only when he's like a prince or a king in her eyes. She loves to do what he wants. And she pushes aside anything he hates. This is the way of daughters of Israel and sons of Israel, and in these ways their living together will be pleasant and rich. Remember, I told you the Rambam gives his own guarantees. The living together will be pleasant and rich. There will be arguments here and there, there will be a bit of resistance here and there, but as long as one can retain these two ends, because everything else flows, as long as he is able to command her admiration by his sensitivity and his imposition and his giving, his generosity and everything that went with him, he is able to command her admiration to the extent that she is able to give him more honor than he deserves and to see him as a king, as a prince, then the marriage is absolutely safe. Nothing can possibly rock that marriage. Now we've completed to discuss the basis of a marriage. That's really all we've done. We now know what the rock of the marriage is. Once you've got this, the whole thing is okay. And it demands a tremendous degree of educational sophistication in the husband and the wife. They must both be made human beings, not half human beings. The only thing they're lacking when they come to marriage should be one another. They shouldn't be lacking in themselves. They shouldn't be inadequate. And if they are inadequate, they have to work on themselves. A husband mustn't turn to his wife and say, the marriage isn't working because of you. And a wife mustn't turn to a husband and say, the marriage isn't working because of you. If a marriage isn't working, it's because the two partners or one of the two partners is inadequate. And he needs help and he needs to be educated. And one has to be patient. We're talking about an education that runs many years. I can't repeat and stress it enough. We're not talking about overnight solutions, because the problems are not overnight problems. The problems are created by 25 years of bad education. And 25 years of bad education can't just be turned right by one magical visit to a marriage counselor or to a rabbi. I'm talking about a long, hard slog, but one that is so rich in results and one which is so rewarding in terms of what the marriage and life in general is able to give one back. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there are two problems I want to discuss with you. The one is that, as I said in the beginning, I was going to try very hard to fit these into four lectures. At the moment, what I still have to do is love outside the marital relationship and sex outside the marital relationship, premarital relationship, extramarital relationship, relationship to in-laws and outer family. The home as a concept, we're talking about husband-wife, but husband-wife together make more than, it's more than, it's 1 and 1 makes 10 or 11. It's not 1 and 1 makes 2. It's husband and wife, in addition to creating a marriage, also creates a home. But one has to know how to build a home and what constitutes a home. And then there's romance, which is terribly important. How to preserve that romance. I think you're beginning to get an idea of it already. The basis has to be solid. Then you can have romance. But you can't allow romance to paper over the cracks. Don't expect it of romance, and don't try it on. If there are cracks, the romance won't paper over it. It's very dangerous. So we've got to discuss romance, and then we've got to come onto the sexual relationship. Which means I've either got to leave out basically one lecture, which would be the home and romance, and go on next week to the sexual relationship, or we have to extend the lecture series by 1 week. So, since I heard some voices saying extending, are there people, don't be embarrassed, are there people who feel that we shouldn't, that we should rather cut out, because I know it means another Wednesday night for you, and it's not easy for everybody. And 4 weeks I thought was just the right kind of length, 5 weeks is already long. Can you manage another week? Good, thank you very much. That will ease the pressure as far as next week is concerned. Remember, next week is on Tuesday night, not on Wednesday night. Is it next week or is it on Tuesday night? Yes. Lastly, I want to put an idea to you which I would like you to think about. I think it's a very exciting idea, but I would like substantial participation. I find two things wrong with these series, with the series that we're having now. The one is that there's so much ground to cover. There are questions that should arise out of these discussions. There is application. Really, we should stop here for a few years and you should try it out and come back and say where how it's going and we should develop it. Because we're talking about life, we're not talking about academics. It's real, it has to be tried, it has to be worked. We should sit down and break up into groups and compare how it's going and why it isn't going and where it isn't going. These are the kind of things, we're not talking about terribly intimate things, we're talking about simple principles of living together. In addition to that, somebody raised the whole question that it's all very nice, we're talking about saving our own marriages, which is terribly important. But we're not talking enough about how to ensure that our children don't run into the same problems we're running into, and so on. Which means education of children is intricately tied up with this whole discussion. That's the first thing that's wrong, is that it's just all too compressed, it's all too compact, and I don't think one can absorb all of this that quickly. The second problem is that I'm very happy to say that the majority of you, I don't know. I say happy because it's always nice to meet new people and find people at that. And I guess that you don't know me either. And that's the other problem, that there just isn't enough opportunity to get to know one another and to develop these ideas further and, as I say, create a bit of a relationship which can then develop and grow into something much bigger. So my idea was that we, all of us, or most of us, take a weekend off and go out into the country for a Shabbat. Out of town somewhere. It doesn't have to be far out of town. It can just be a few miles out of town, and we take over a retreat or a motel or something, and we spend the whole Shabbat together. And we'll dedicate the Shabbat to the discussion of child-parent relationships, mainly. But also we'll have these discussions, and we'll have sessions, and we'll try and get a bit of discussion and a bit of practical things going. We'll take the children with us, and I'll watch you relating to your children. And I'll watch you relating to each other, and I'll point out where things are wrong and how things should be, so that the whole thing becomes a little bit more real. It's quite a schlep. It's going to need a bit of organization. We'll have to have some volunteers to organize and to help and to arrange and so on. But I think it would be something incredibly exciting if we can do it. So we don't need any answers now. Give it a bit of thought. I would like to do it soon after this, within 3-4 weeks maximum. So that we've still got a bit of the momentum after the last lecture. And as I say, we'll go out. It's not a difficult thing to organize and to arrange, and something which could be extremely enriching. We'll leave on a Friday afternoon. We'll be back on a Sunday morning. So I think it's something that everybody can manage and afford time-wise. Please give it a bit of thought, and if I could get a bit of a response from you next time, it will only be worthwhile if we really have a really nice response, because one doesn't want this thing to be narrow, one wants it to be rich, and the way it will be enriched, whoever comes along, it adds to the richness of it, and the fewer people there are, the less rich it can be. So it would be important, I think, that as many of you as possible are able to actually make it. As I say, please give it some thought, and maybe you have some ideas of what to do with it. In fact, maybe there's some specific things you would like, ways in which you would like to handle it, and some specific ideas you would like discussed. That we can still work out what you want to do with it, but I think it's something that holds a lot of promise. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, so that's all for this evening, and we see each other again, same time and place, but on Tuesday night rather than Wednesday night.